The novel Remembrance of Things Past by Marcel Proust famously opens with the smell and taste of a small French cake called a Madeleine, which has been dipped in tea. And as that morsel is lifted to the mouth, the sensations trigger memories that had long been dormant in a man. Memories that go on to fill many, many pages if you know anything about Marcel Proust and his writings. Another novel that is near and dear to my own heart, Faulkner's Absalom. Absalom begins with the smell of wisteria wafting in through an open window. This launches the narrator into a recollection of the history of his town and how the actions of long departed people had affected it to the present day. Since we keep our windows closed at our place, I have to go outside to enjoy that evocative smell from our own wisteria vines. That kind of thing takes place all the time, doesn't it? Especially as you grow older. Some sight or some smell sparks a memory. And we spend a little time, perhaps, in the warm glow of nostalgia. Is that a good thing? Thinking back through the past, can it be harmful? Warren Wiersbe has some wise words on the subject. The past, he says, must be a rudder to guide us and not an anchor to hold us back. We might want to hold that thought in our minds as we go through our text tonight. For we are going to see that Job will review his past for the benefit of his audience, which by God's design includes us. His past is not brought to mind by some pleasurable sight or taste or smell. To the contrary, his recitation is brought on by the accusations of his counselors. We have seen their insistence over many weeks on his previous sins. This has been going on pretty much since they started speaking. Job was in the wrong. But now the charges are going to get very specific, and they are very serious. And Job is therefore driven to defend himself in some very specific terms. Job was the most righteous man on the earth when his difficulties came upon him. And I do not believe that that has changed during his trials. Despite the sins that Job has clearly committed as he has struggled with why this is all happening to him. What tonight's passage will clarify for us is just how godly and fruitful a man he had been over the years. We can ponder how well we think Job handles his trip down memory lane. But apart from that, we ought to be challenged by the good works of this man. He truly becomes an example of sacrificial service, a person to imitate by God's grace. And I think that we do also have plenty of preparation here for coming to this table and remembering the selflessness of the one of whom even Job is only a pale reflection. We begin with the accusations regarding Job's past that are made by Eliphaz in chapter 22. And this is Eliphaz's final contribution to this debate. These words follow Job's common sense contention that the wicked do indeed prosper. At times, at least. despite the words of his counselors to the contrary. We are only going to look at the first 11 verses of the response of Eliphaz to what Job had to say. We'll begin with verses 1 through 5. Then Eliphaz the Temanite responded, "Can a vigorous man be of use to God, or a wise man be useful to himself? Is there any pleasure to the Almighty if you are righteous, or profit if you make your ways perfect? Is it because of your reverence that he reproves you, that he enters into judgment against you? Is not your wickedness great and your iniquities without end?" Well, this is really just a personal attack. Boiling this down, Eliphaz is saying, "Well, you're one to talk, Job. So now the cheese is going to preach to us?" Job was being judged for his great wickedness, so he was disqualified as a messenger. Who are you to bloviate on about all these things? Whether his words were true or not, hey, that was beside the point. He wasn't the right person to be saying this. The meaning of verses 2 and 3 seems to be that God does not hand out reward based on what men can do for him, because he has no need of anything. God, oh, that part's okay. But then the idea is that God rather rewards based on merit, and Job had none. Eliphaz mockingly brings up the question of whether Job was being punished for being righteous. Is that what we're seeing here, Job? Is that what you're trying to tell? You're really righteous. You're innocent. And that's why God's punishing you. We would all agree that God does not do that, but would God test someone for the purpose of discipline? For the purpose of demonstrating enduring faith? For the purpose of gaining wisdom that could then be shared with others? Could God be doing that? Could these things end up glorifying God in a way that was even greater than if he had just kept on giving untold blessings? Again, that possibility was not even up for discussion. That kind of an idea just could not penetrate the minds of these counselors. And then come the details of Job's sinful ways. Oh, they've got his number. Job wasn't going to be pulling the wool over their eyes about his activities. Look at verses 5 through 11. "Is not your wickedness great and your iniquities without end? For you have taken pledges of your brothers without cause and stripped men naked. To the weary, you have given no water to drink, and from the hungry, you have withheld bread. But the earth belongs to the mighty man, and the honorable man dwells in it. You have sent widows away empty, and the strength of the orphans has been crushed. Therefore, snares surround you, and sudden dread terrifies you, or darkness so that you cannot see, and an abundance of water covers you." Well, what a great, gory layout we have here. Up to this point, the accusations of the three have been veiled, right? They've been talking about the wicked man and what happens to him with, you know, many a meaningful look toward Job. Are you getting the hint, Job, when we're talking about this kind of person and what happens to him? And he hadn't been. But in verse 6, the gloves really come off. And Eliphaz says, "You!" You know, this has the flavor of, "You know, Job, I didn't really want, you know, to have to go into it this far. I, I hoped you would pick up on what we were saying. I was hoping you would come around. But now I'm just going to have to come right out and say, thou art the man. You're the wicked man. See, Eliphaz did not have an answer for Job's presentation of the mystery of God's ways. Did you notice that? There was absolutely no addressing of what Job had been saying, which we covered a couple weeks ago or more, where he had pointed out all the ways in which their principle of reaping and sowing did not work. He does not address all of those instances that were brought up by Job. No, he can't. So what's he going to do? Well, in time-honored fashion, he's going to indulge in a litany of charges against Job instead. The best defense here is what? A stronger offense. Job had committed so many iniquities from which to choose. He took clothing from people to encourage them to keep their word, took it as a way to make sure they kept a promise. And then he would hold on to their clothing even when it meant leaving them in discomfort. It's interesting that the law that would come to Israel down the road prohibited this very act. Reading from Exodus chapter 22, verse 26. If you ever take your neighbor's cloak as a pledge, okay, that wasn't prohibited. But if you did do that, you are to return it to him before the sun sets. Okay, so there's provision in the law to make sure that people were not left without what they needed to make it through the cool of the night. And you can also jot down Deuteronomy 24:17 on that same kind of idea, and widows are brought in there. But then we see that Job was the very opposite of a generous and hospitable man. Despite his great wealth, he was not only the most righteous man on the earth, but this was basically one of the, if not the most wealthy man on the earth. Job had a lot, and what did he do with that? Oh, there'd be no gleaning of his fields, according to the counselors. Not at all. His servants would beat the poor back from his land. You're not getting anything from here, even what's left after we've taken our bountiful harvest. Get out of here. Get off our land. That was the way Job treated people, and his dealings with widows and orphans. Very harsh. Again, Exodus 22:22, you shall not afflict any widow or orphan. And we know all through the law and beyond into the prophets, the emphasis on treating the widows and the orphans with justice and generosity. And that was one of the reasons they were eventually kicked out of the land. It was because they would not obey this. And Job's just, right in there with those who will not follow God's commands on this. Job had no pity. These words are a terrible indictment for a man in this culture. I mean, this would be bad for anybody, even in modern day America, which is so independent and kind of selfishly oriented. But think about it in his culture, a culture of, hospitality just being a given, a duty. No wonder God was pouring out his anger upon Job. What's the only problem with these charges? We know that there is not one shred of truth to any of this. God had declared Job righteous. You don't need anything more than that. So why did not these three men know that this was slander? How could they say this about someone who they had cared enough about to come and help and supposedly comfort? Eliphaz was saying this, and it wasn't like the others were, "Hey, Eliphaz, whoa! Back off! That was way out of bounds!" No, this is like, you know, they're like, "Well, you finally said it, you know, I was wondering if I was going to have to, but, you know, okay, now it's finally out there." They know that they do not have any evidence for what Eliphaz is saying. Maybe they did not know Job very well after all. But, on the other hand, it seems mostly that their desire to uphold their simplistic view of God overcame their sense of justice, overcame their sense of charity, overcame the bonds of fellowship that they had with them. It just shows that the power of wanting to hold on to certain personal frameworks and perspectives on God and how He works, how powerful that is. It will allow you to absolutely destroy a relationship and not think, and think that you're doing right. They believed that Job had done these things. Why? Because his circumstances dictated to them that he must have done these things. What else could explain what he was going through? He had to have been that kind of person. I also think that Eliphaz might well have been indulging in one of those time-honored tricks of the detective trade. He was acting like he knew what Job had been doing in order to kind of create that sense of guilt in him so that Job would confess. He would finally repent like they've been telling him to do if he could apply enough pressure in this way. "We know, you know, all that you've been doing." He was spewing assumptions, telling himself, "I'm only doing this for Job's good. He will thank me for this tough love when this is all over." But as we move to chapter 27, we find that Eliphaz's hopes are dashed. All of that false witness that he had borne against Job goes for naught. Job is determined to defend his past. Verses 1 through 6 of chapter 27. "Then Job continued his discourse and said, 'As God lives, who has taken away my right, and the Almighty, who has embittered my soul, for as long as life is in me, and the breath of God is in my nostrils.'" Okay, he's really building it up here, okay? He's saying there's no possibility of this happening. "My lips certainly will not speak unjustly, nor will my tongue mutter deceit. Far be it from me that I should declare you right. Till I die, I will not put away my integrity from me." "I hold fast my righteousness and will not let it go. My heart does not reproach any of my days." Wow. Now, these words came after the creation truths that we looked at a few weeks ago. Job has again stated that God's ways are not our ways. He just looked at it from a different perspective, how we see God working in His creation. That there are things about that you can't figure out. So why, again, counselors, are you coming at me with these simplistic principles of how God is working in this instance? God is mysterious in his use of what he's made, and that includes humanity. We can't understand every circumstance and how it fits into the big picture. Job is coming to this, stumblingly coming to this realization that there is something more complex than what he had always understood about God's ways, but the counselors keep holding him back from really getting very far with that. And now he addresses the charges against him. The counselors would not accept Job's view as ultimately incomprehensible, and this has led them into slander. But Job cannot join them in falsehood. He's saying, I'm not going to play your game just to kind of stay in your good graces or whatever. He will not be cowed into confessing what he has not done. And that's certainly right. Job will hold fast to his righteousness because his conscience did not reproach him. This kind of sounds like Paul a little bit there. Paul, you know, said that his conscience bore him witness that he was telling the truth at times. And that is what Job is saying here. Job does not understand why God has put him in circumstances where he does appear to be guilty of great evil, according to everything that they had always kind of thought about how God worked. He doesn't understand why it looks this way. He does not know why God has not yet vindicated him in the eyes of others, just allowed him to just be beaten down and beaten down. But he will not be moved from his testimony of his basic innocence prior to his trials. He's not saying that he was perfect or did not need sacrifices for in regard to his sin. We've already seen that he does have a great sense of the need for a mediation in regard to his sin. But in the way that the counselors are looking at what he did, he said, I'm innocent. I did not bring on my trials with my sin. It's in chapter 29 that Job gets into the details of his defense. And here the reader finally gets an eyewitness account of what Job was actually doing before his miseries came upon him. It's taken us a long while to really get to information about, well, what was he doing? But in verses 1 through 11, we find that he enjoyed close fellowship with God, and he enjoyed respect from all men. Let's read that, 29, 1 through 11. And Job again took up his discourse and said, "Oh, that I were as in months gone by, as in the days when God watched over me, when his lamp shone over my head, and by his light I walked through darkness. As I was in the prime of my days, when the friendship of God was over my tent, when the Almighty was yet with me and my children were around me, when my steps were bathed in butter and the rock poured out for me streams of oil, when I went out to the gate of the city, when I took my seat in the square, the young men saw me and hid themselves, and the old men arose and stood. The princes stopped talking and put their hands on their mouths. The voice of the nobles was hushed and their tongues stuck to their palate. For when the ear heard, it called me blessed. And when the eye saw, it gave witness of me." Job did not have to skip over decades to reminisce about the good old days. Now, he didn't have to go way back. Those good old days were just a few months back. At that time, from Job's perspective now, God was watching over him. God was protecting him. God was lighting his way through the darkness of this world's pitfalls. This was prime time for Job. It's amazing how quickly God can turn our lives around, you know, going in one direction or another. He can just bring a series of circumstances. We find ourselves just going, you know, in a, just a very different direction in life. He can just do that so quickly. And Job's thinking, oh, you know, I had been in good health. You know, I hardly had a sick day in my life. Everything was going my way in all of my dealings. My business efforts were all just going so well. And the counsel of God just, it was so clear in my life. I just had that sense that I was walking so closely in fellowship with God. But note all the past tenses here. Do you see all that? This is how it used to be. God had departed somewhere along the line for reasons that Job could not discern. Job pictures how it was with his children talking and joking and enjoying life around him. Boy, that, you know, talk about pangs and bittersweet memories. He remembers the sumptuous meals that they would enjoy. He sees himself sitting in the gate of the city with the leaders of the people. How the men would greet him with honor. When Job spoke, people listened. When he had shared his wisdom, there really wasn't much more to be said. Everyone just kind of went, yeah, that's the way it is. It's clear that Job had led an almost idyllic life. He'd worked hard and been careful with his spiritual disciplines, yes. It wasn't like he had just lazed his way to this. But there had been a lot to live for. He'd been blessed, and everyone knew it. So, we pause here to ask the question, is nostalgia a good thing? That's what Job is doing. He's saying, oh man, I remember those times. Good, good times. Should we spend time running through our minds those wonderful moments and people and scenes that we enjoyed in the past? As with most matters, I think we can answer both yes and no, depending on what such reveries produce. What's the warning signal here? You know, you look at verse 2. Oh, that I were as in months gone by. Job wants to go back to those days. His nostalgia is clearly making him discontent with the present. And he's using circumstances as a guide to God's love for him. Do you notice that? He's associating those good times of the past as when God was really loving him. God cared about him back then. It is so clear. He could feel it. But now, since he was no longer in the prime of life, to say the least, God had decided not to be his friend anymore. But of course, Job is wrong. God was just as involved in working for Job's good right now in the present as he had ever been in the past. So nostalgia is a hindrance to Job's spiritual growth right now. It's keeping him from trusting God for how he could be used right now. How God could be glorifying himself right now. The lesson is that we need to be careful about our memories. Be careful. Now for some, it's past sins that are always coming back up before their eyes. Well, in that case, they need to be like Paul in Philippians 3 and forget what lies behind, reaching forward to what lies ahead. But even good memories can be dangerous. We should leave behind anything that becomes a false security that replaces Christ in our affections. But while we do need to be cautious about taking too many trips down memory lane, thinking about the past can be an encouragement for the present. So here I want to put in a plug for the remembrance of things past. How often are God's people told to remember the mighty deeds of God? Well, those are things that they had experienced, that they took joy in, that must have been fun to remember, I would think. The waves parted for us, we walked across on dry land, and then it came together over all of the Egyptians and destroyed them, and we went on our merry way. Is that not something that you would enjoy remembering, thinking about? Man, I'd be running that through my mind all the time. Whoa, that was sweet. And God wanted them to do that as long as they were thinking about God delivered them. Yeah, remember those kinds of things. When nostalgia becomes a means of thanks and praise to God and a reminder that we can trust God for any difficulty that we are currently enduring, then I believe we're on safe ground. See, you want to bring what you learned there and saw there into the present. Yeah, God can do that again. In fact, God is doing that again, whether we can exactly see it or not. I think all the time about what a wonderful life God has given me. I think back through my life and think God has just been so good, been so amazingly gracious to me. And I'm reassured by that he intends to bring me through whatever remains of my mortal life. Whatever I'm going through today, it's not going to change. I know from past experience that the Lord is not going to abandon me. So it's good to think about those kinds of things. But we watch out for nostalgia that represents discontent. Let's finish up with the details of Job's defense in verses 12 through 25. Because I delivered the poor who cried for help and the orphan who had no helper. The blessing of the one ready to perish came upon me, and I made the widow's heart sing for joy. I put on righteousness, and it clothed me. My justice was like a robe and a turban. I was eyes to the blind and feet to the lame. I was a father to the needy, and I investigated the case which I did not know. I broke the jaws of the wicked and snatched the prey from his teeth. Then I thought, I shall die in my nest. And I shall multiply my days as the sand. My root is spread out to the waters, and dew lies all night on my branch. My glory is ever new with me, and my bow is renewed in my hand. To me they listened and waited, and kept silent for my counsel. After my words they did not speak again, and my speech dropped on them. They waited for me as for the rain, and opened their mouth as for the spring rain. I smiled on them when they did not believe, and the light of my face they did not cast down. I chose a way for them and sat as chief and dwelt as a king among the troops, as one who comforted the mourners. I'm not positive of what to make of the because that leads off verse 12. we remember the things that he said in the previous verses, then because I delivered the poor. Is he saying that God blessed him because of the righteous deeds that he performed? If so, I think that he's still struggling with that, you know, perverted view of the counselors, you know, what they've been displaying, that simplistic reaping and sowing principle. Maybe some of that's hanging on, but I think that's more likely that he's saying that he had a good reputation among his fellow citizens because he put his energy and influence and his money where his mouth was. And this is what I really want to emphasize about Job. He had street cred, we could say, because he was actually getting his hands dirty with the basic issues of life. He was out there helping people. He wasn't pulling himself in and isolating himself in his fortress of wealth and just figuring, well, whatever happens to other people, God can look out for that. Not at all. Here we see beyond doubt that Job was a man of righteous deeds. He was not the monster being portrayed by Eliphaz. Very much to the contrary. Now, sometimes we think of righteousness in terms of what we don't do. I'm a righteous person, you know, because I don't drink and I don't smoke and I don't go to those kinds of movies and I don't play cards and I don't, you know, I don't fellowship with that kind of a person. And so, and I am therefore a righteous person. And righteousness is active. It's outward. Job had a worked out righteousness. This is why God considered him to be the most righteous man on the earth, was because of these things that he has just said, that he was doing. Job heard the cries of the poor and responded practically in acts of kindness. He came to the aid of the orphan and the widow. He rescued many from impending death. He seems to have been involved with the blind and the crippled. Impressive, is it not? A man at the top, dealing with that strata of society, hands-on. When Job saw injustice, he didn't pass by on the other side of the road. He took the time and the effort to investigate what had gone wrong. This is a little bit like Onesiphorus this morning, who searched out. Paul took that initiative. Job took the initiative. If he thought maybe something had gone wrong, he investigated until he got to the bottom of it. He seems to have confronted unjust judges and other wicked men, preventing them from taking advantage of those without power in society. There's going to be more of this evidence given in chapter 31. But this kind of activity is exactly in line with the concerns of God in Scripture. I'm personally challenged by Job's compassion, his kindness, his effort. Again, we see that Job was a wise counselor to many. He actually helped people with their sorrows and their questions, in contrast to these buffoons who were before him now. He had been somebody who actually said something worth hearing to other people. He maintained a benevolent, upbeat spirit. Whatever the response was to his giving out of his wisdom, he just rolled along, doing what was right. Of course, we do kind of hear that sour note in verses 18 through 20. Did Job think that his righteous deeds guaranteed that he would continually prosper? Whether that was the case or not, he did seem to presume that things would roll along in prosperity and that he would go out on a high note. After many years of this abundance and charity, Job figured that he would always be the giver, not one who would need help from others. Well, that can be an error. The irony, of course, is that now he was the needy one, and what? No one was taking his side. No one was coming to his aid. Where were all those whom he had delivered? There had to be dozens, if not hundreds, of those who really owed a lot to Job and what he'd done for them. This is not exactly like It's a Wonderful Life. You know, with all the townspeople showing up, now that Job's in big trouble and bringing him gifts and thanking him for all that he had done. We're not getting that kind of a nice happy ending here. Now Job was despised, and any words that he spoke were immediately rebuked. Oh, it had all turned around. Well, as we conclude, I have various thoughts that can't be fully pursued. Maybe they can be topics for discussion next Lord's Day. So if something, you know, kind of gets your interest, so let's bring it up on next Sunday morning in Sunday school. Well, here's one that's a question. Should Job have defended himself in this way? Are we the right messenger regarding our own good deeds? I don't know whether I have ever made a widow's heart sing for joy. I kind of hope that I have, but I'm not really sure. But I doubt that if I found that I had, that I would produce a poem about it for the edification of others. But that's what Job did. It's hard to know when to defend ourselves, isn't it? Now, sometimes we know the flesh is just right in there, goading us along. But sometimes it is hard to know. It's hard to know how much detail to go into in defending ourselves. How much do you say about yourself? We don't want to let error stand. That doesn't seem to be our calling. Let everybody think something that's just blatantly untrue. Sometimes to allow ourselves to be slandered would be to harm the faith of others. To let evil men get the upper hand. But at other times, it seems best to let our lives and other witnesses make the case and keep silent. Jesus and Paul did not characteristically say all that could be said in the face of false charges. But at times they did speak. Paul famously spoke as if insane in 2 Corinthians. Much like Job, laying it out there what he had sacrificed for the Lord. That was because the spiritual health of a church was at stake. I don't see Paul just, you know, doing that for himself. But there are times. I just think that we have to seek the Lord's guidance in any given situation and be as wise as we know how to be. Looking at the other side of the equation, certainly we should allow this passage to make us more cautious about accusation. Is there a place for accusation in the church, in a family? Yes. We do not allow sin to run amok because we will not point out wicked behavior. We have a process for discipline that's given to us. But we do not play games like Eliphaz. We don't convince ourselves that it is for the best if we make assumptions about a person. We make very sure that we have clear evidence of sin. Sin. S-I-N, sin. Before we make charges. But as we come to this table, I think that the main thought I have is what an inspiration we have here to perform righteous deeds. We're always quick in our circles to cry for grace, and rightly so. Grace, we need grace. We need to hear, you know, that we are forgiven. We need to hear that the Lord is merciful, that it is His ways with us are not based on our merit and so forth. But sometimes I feel that we cannot talk about our responsibilities before God without being called legalists. Job pleased God more than any other person on the earth because he was acting righteously toward others. That's what his righteousness was really all about. He was serving others sacrificially, God and man. This is pure and undefiled religion, a la James. He did that by God's grace. I totally understand that. But he did do it. Job should be one of our heroes of the faith. Job should be someone that we would want to emulate. And while we seek the grace that is offered at this table, we remember that we are to imitate the deeds that secured our salvation. Imitate that kind of sacrificial effort. Do not some of the lines in this chapter 29 speak to the actions of the Lord Jesus? I had Joel stop where he did for a reason. I don't know if you noticed that the hymn that we sang right after that picked right up with this idea of being rescued. Because I delivered the poor who cried for help. Okay, who are we really hearing, you know, behind Job here? Because I delivered the poor who cried for help. First part to 13, the blessing of the one ready to perish came upon me. 15, I was eyes to the blind. 16, I was a father to the needy. 17, I broke the jaws of the wicked and snatched the prey from his teeth. We now participate in a remembrance of things past. This is the truth about Jesus' past. And we speak it in the face of all who would deny his righteousness. This was a righteous man who sacrificed himself on behalf of others. The ultimate example of that. So, as we smell the fruit of the vine, as we taste the bread, let's remember his works and allow them to affect our present and our future. Let's pray. Lord, all righteousness has its source in you. We know that. We don't have any of our own. And we know that we must see that to even be someone who can rightly come to this table. By your grace, and only by that, are we what we are. But while we desperately seek and know that we receive your forgiveness here, we also seek the strength to be men and women who sacrifice ourselves for the good of others. We ask this in Jesus' name, amen.